This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
From the Trackhall Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeremy Scott. We've got a big show for you today. We're starting off our season reviews with F4 and FR America's Eric Brennan from FanRacing.live will be joining us here in just a little bit. But in between that, we have some interesting interviews, sit-downs, have you, that we've procured for your listening enjoyment, especially if you are safely getting ready for Thanksgiving. First off, Dave Dusick of Racetrack Engineering sits down with me, talks a little bit about what they do and how you've probably seen their work, and it's quite interesting to see where they've come from and where they are today. Also, Mike Marini, he's going to join us. He is the PR for a lot of junior formula teams around the country, but more namely, he's going to talk about the joining of HMD Motorsports and Global Racing Group. Those two teams announced an alliance four-car Indy Lights team for next season, and they just got off some testing as well, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Other than that, if you have any questions, you can leave us a voicemail, 815-714-9260. Drop us a line, insideopenwheel@gmail.com, Twitter at insideopenwheel. Also find us on Facebook on Inside Open Wheel. I'm going to start off with this before I bring in our driver analyst, Charlie Ante. We will not have an episode next week because of Thanksgiving. I'm sure I'm probably going to be on the bed withering in pain by the end of the week because I ate too much turkey again. And Charlie, I've got to say this. I'm kind of afraid because I've been tapped to smoke a turkey this year.
Oh, that sounds really good. I'm usually in charge of the mashed potatoes.
Shut up! Jerk.
I found a recipe for mashed potatoes. It's like at least 1/3 butter, maybe a little bit more.
Ooh.
So Thanksgiving is a good excuse to eat that poorly or well, depending on your perspective. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I might not survive till next week. I might have an artery blockage or two by then.
Just don't make mashed potatoes north of the border.
You can do that as long as you're careful with the heat and don't. Yeah, that's a whole thing.
It's an inside joke. So anyway,
I'm surprised you would want to bring that up.
Well, I thought that's where you're headed. So
I had forgotten about that.
Oh, trust me, I will never let that one down. But especially for my own wife, who's a culinary expert in our family. She's actually been tasked with stuffing, which she put sausage in, and she's making a sweet potato bake. I'll have to give you the recipe later. And I know that you and yours are going to be getting a gift from us whenever she decides to make cookies. So just a heads up on that.
Ooh.
Yes, because we've talked about that before. Okay, now off food. Apparently, I'm hungry. A couple of big news coming out. We've been kind of following the Indy Lights story. We'll have more on one team here in a little bit, but Kyle Kirkwood finally has a seat. He's going to be back with Andretti Autosport. Remember that he had a scholarship for winning the 2019 Indy Pro 2000 Championship, and he's going to, in essence, he's going to return with Andretti Autosport. He had one session under his belt from the initial Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg. But a 22-year-old going to run a full season in Indy Lights. So that's one of the four Andretti Autosport teams seats that are filled. I can say this also, Charlie, on Instagram yesterday. I saw it this morning. Nate Arnada actually did one of those Instagram stories from the Yunkos Racing Shop. They have an Indy car ready, but he said that they're going to fit a seat for him in one of their Indy Lights cars. So I have a feeling, we might see a two-car Yunkos team because I think that Stingray Rob's probably going to stay within the team. He'd be smart to do that.
Interesting, yeah.
And I was talking with one of my buddies, and he's like, you know, well, that's out of left field. It was. I was actually kind of surprised. I saw that. It's like, well, that woke me right up.
Who was, who would his teammate be?
I would imagine Stingray Rob, because he's got the scholarship from winning the Indy Pro 2000 championship.
Right. Yeah, right. Stingray Rob with who?
With Yunkos.
Right. Did you say a two-car team?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a two-car team.
With who?
Nate Arnada, probably, if he gets the funding.
Ah, okay. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kirkwood is basically cashing in on the scholarship that he won last year.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So, yes, things are becoming more clear.
Yes.
As we come on.
Yes. Yes. Maybe I should drink some liquor so we all could be on the same page. All right. another story coming out of this one's actually coming out of Formula One, and I'm trying to get both drivers for this one. I've actually contacted one of the drivers that's been rumored to have an IndyCar seat for next year. Another one is his teammate. This one comes from nextgenauto.com, and I believe that is a French website, with the title, Magnussen Not Ruling Out Haas Reserve Role Indy 500. Now, if you remember, his father, Jan Magnussen, actually ran in CART. And apparently this is something that Kevin's been wanting to do before he got the Haas ride. So I would be all for seeing Kevin Magnussen extend his career in Formula One. I think that that would be fantastic. And if you listen to last week's interview with Will Buxton, he talks about how, you know, these, you know, more namely Sergio Perez comes in, you know, thinks that IndyCar is not a viable option because they do ovals, but then finds out, well, wait a second, I don't have to do all the ovals. I think we're going to see a lot more of this as time goes on with some of these drivers who may not be able to get a seat in Formula One, you know, in the coming years, you know, come over and play in IndyCar.
Yeah, I wonder as time goes on and as we see the aero screen, how what effects it has on the oval safety, if maybe these road course drivers might start reconsidering doing ovals.
I'd love to see Jimmy Johnson give his hand at ovals.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd like to see what these Formula One drivers could do on ovals too.
Yeah, because you look at some of the drivers who've come over from Europe, and I'm going to use Santino Ferrucci as an example. You know, I think they could do well. Nigel Mansell, what did he win primarily in CART? It wasn't road courses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it will be interesting to see what happens. Yeah, I think now that IndyCar has developed the aero screen, I think we're going to see a lot more drivers come on board. And I think we're also going to see a lot more drivers come from Europe to run in Indy Lights, you know, from the Junior Formula Series. Just because they have a chance to win a scholarship to run a full IndyCar season. You don't get that in Formula 3 or Formula 2, but you get it here in the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the allure to make it into Formula 1 is the big draw in the European ladder series. And it doesn't quite have the same draw in IndyCar, but like you said, there's the scholarship series, which sort of makes it a bit more concrete, I suppose.
Well, and you also have to wonder, too, how many of these drivers saw what Alexander Rossi did as he was coming up through the European ranks, came over to IndyCar because he didn't get the seat at Manor, ends up winning the, you know, the biggest race in the world, the 500, and has success in, you know, here in America. How much of that effect is that, you think?
That's a good point.
You know, and you can also make the argument too of the new financial global structure after this COVID-19 pandemic. You know, could it be a little cheaper to run, you know, an Indy Lights program, a partial IndyCar program, or, you know, just, you know, road courses only?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That's an entirely other different conversation that we could have. What is the motorsport scene going to look like? What is the global financial scene going to look like after the financial crisis is resolved, or at least sort of settles down?
I think that's a good subject, because one of the things I did want to talk about too. So I know that we've been talking about doing straight off season, you know, Legends of Open Wheel Racing. Okay. I still think it's a good idea. However, I think here's how we're going to work this season. And this is the first time Charlie's heard of this this idea that popped in my head earlier today. I think it's going to work out. But, you know, we've had discussions off the air. So this season, we will have the Legends of off-season. We'll have the Legends of Open Wheel Racing. But we're also going to have some stories behind Open Wheel Racing. Charlie knows about that. But I want to dive deeper into to subjects like this, you know, like, okay, why are we seeing all these Europeans come over and race? Yeah, yeah, we know the product is really good here in the States, but there's a deeper reason. You know, it's something that needs to be explored. And I think that, you know, people want to know about more about, okay, we saw Linus Lundqvist come over here. Well, we know why he came over here. Are there going to be more drivers like Linus to come over and, you know, give a good challenge to our drivers who have come up through the ranks of karting? You know, maybe they've done some SCCA, they've done some NASA, or, you know, PCA, and then they decide they want to go over into open wheel racing, or, you know, they're Jordan Missick karting Radical Cup Formula Regional Americas, you know, stuff like that. Good.
You know, that sort of reminds me of something that I've been thinking about for a long time is maybe another thing that we could explore in the off season is kind of taking a deep dive and contextualizing the sort of modern budget structure and like why racing is as expensive as it is.
Right.
I mean, when you look at for example, take Atlantic Racing in the 70s, even if you consider inflation, it was significantly cheaper than, for an example, an Indy Lights team or a Pro 2000 team is today. And why is that? Why has racing become exponentially more expensive today than it was way back then?
Yeah, that's a great dive that we can get into too. Also, Charlie and I have been talking about this too. We are going to do a show sometime in the off season into what it takes to get in, you know, to make that leap from a club racing to a semi-pro racing, from a semi-pro racing to a pro racing. I have reached out some feelers, and we're going to have this here sometime in the near future. I will let you know this, but this offseason is not going to lack from talent. If you have any other ideas, please feel free to email us insideopenwheel@gmail.com. Also, as driver announcements do come through the pipeline, we will cover those. We will talk to some of these drivers. And I'm working on getting IndyCar champion Scott Dixon on, Jimmy Johnson. We're hoping to get on sometime soon. There's a lot that we need to get into, and I'm trying to get this good content so you, the listener, are entertained throughout the year. And please, as I said last week, share this with your friends, because we're going to have some good features here in the next couple of months. I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's I think we've got some good stuff coming on the off season.
Yeah. So, speaking of off season, we still don't know if when the Nashville to Indy Lights announcement's coming. I'm saying it's Nashville. I'm fully saying that Nashville is going to be a doubleheader for Indy Lights. I'm excited for that too.
I would hope so. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
But yeah, I think we have all our schedules out now for IndyCar. Oh, we do. Yes, because I made an Excel spreadsheet that I need to send to you. So, oh, I did send that to you actually. Did I?
I don't think so.
I'll send it to you.
Oh, wait, maybe yeah, you did.
Okay. Yeah. Because I know I sent it to Missick and he double checked. He goes, yeah, that looks good. So, but yeah, this could be a fun off season, especially, you know, and if we have another situation where the off season gets extended, we're going to have plenty of content. So we're not going to be hurting for content. So we will take a break for Thanksgiving. We'll take a 2-week hiatus for Christmas and New Year's. I might plug together some of the best stuff, you know, or you can go back and listen to some of our other interviews. But the more we get in the off season, we're going to have so much content that you're going to be asking for less, I think, at this point.
It's so much content, you're going to be tired of all the content.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to be like, God, I wish these guys would just shut up about it. All right, so anything else new?
Not off the top of my head.
I say I haven't found anything really. Some British driver won another championship in some international series. That's all I know right now. But yeah, pretty light news week except for what we're going to be talking about later on. But coming up next is Dave Dusick from Racetrack Engineering talking about what he does and what that company's all about next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel, Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
We'll get more into our season reviews here after a little bit of a break. Now, if you've watched any of the Road to Indy series, or you've been to an IndyCar race, an IMSA race, the Circuit of the Americas, or almost any North American track, you've probably seen a little footprint of this next guest product. And it's really interesting because he's one of the foremost, I would say he's one of the foremost safety innovators in our industry. He's Racetrack Engineering's Dave Dusick. Dave, thanks for joining us. I know this is your, 25th year doing this, whether it's with a company or yourself. So you're really creating a footprint that a lot of people just don't know about.
Wow, buddy. What an intro. No pressure. Now I have to live up to your introduction. I'm grateful. This was our 25th year working as a professional in motorsports, and personally, 1982, so I can't do that math. Is that 38 or 39 years of actually participating in the sport? So yeah. It's definitely been my whole life, and I'm grateful to be a part of this community for sure.
Well, of course, full disclosure, Dave and I have known each other since I've been a professional in racing. So I've kind of watched his footprint. I've watched it grow from racetrack, from the beginnings of Racetrack Engineering. But nonetheless, right now you're working on a little project. You have several projects actually. One of the ones that I've really liked watching is what you've been doing to some smaller road courses that are just getting their start in the past decade or so.
Yeah, it's funny. I grew up in Indiana, so I grew up going to sprint car races at the local dirt tracks. I grew up in Indianapolis Speedrome on Thursday Night Thunder, the USAC midgets. And my first road course race ever was the United States Grand Prix in the year 2000 at Indianapolis. And we had just designed and built and installed all the tire barriers. And I was on tire barrier repair duty. But since 2000, it's become apparent that technology, the greatest opportunity to utilize the value of technology is in road racing because of the sheer number of people it takes to operate racetrack operations at a road course. And so over the last 20 years, we've sort of evolved that way. And we're proud of the fact that we're looking forward into the future and saying, man, what's this road course racing look like in 5, 10, 15 years? And what do we need to do to be ready for the changes that are going to come, whether we like them or not? And fortunately, we have a project down here in Miami that's given us the opportunity to really flex those muscles and learn. And it's been fun, man. I'm excited about where we're going and what's going on.
And, of course, you've made a lot of the innovations at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. You helped out with the Digitron, I'm going to call it, project, where there weren't even, back, in the 80s, people couldn't see the whole track. Now they can from where they're sitting because you have huge screens almost everywhere around the course. You know what's going on. If you can't hear, the PA, you upgraded the PA system. You said, you helped with the road course there at Indianapolis with the tire barriers. So that just blossomed a whole, slew of what's to come now back 20 years ago.
It's really cool, and I'm very, very fortunate and grateful to have had the opportunities we had. But essentially, you just sort of outlined what racetrack engineering is. A lot of people ask, and we're currently working with a marketing company to help us explain, what is racetrack engineering? What does racetrack engineering do? And that's a very complicated answer because essentially we do anything you need us to do. That sounds rather vague when you're in a sales meeting, but to some degree there's truth. You hit the nail on the head. When I was an employee at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I worked underneath the great Kevin Forbes. And Kevin was the expert and leader in innovation in racetrack safety and racetrack design. Kevin is the first one who ever started to build soft walls. If you remember, we had you may not be old enough to remember this, Jeremy. Do you remember the PEDS barrier incident with IROC and
yes.
R.A. Lyon-Dyke? In 1997, I believe.
Yes, I was about 9 years old then. So I'm a youngin.
I was a sophomore or junior in college. But yeah, Kevin was an amazing guy, and And while there were many parties that made the safer barrier ultimately come to fruition, I credit Kevin with the ingenuity and innovation to think outside the box and try to create something. And it took several revisions, and the PEDS barrier was the first. It was basically a plastic version of the safer barrier that was deemed, it, very quickly we learned that it needed to be stronger than plastic, and that's where the steel and the safer came from. But anyway, digressing back, I worked underneath Kevin. And essentially what my job at the Speedway was, what our job as a department was we were responsible for building everything at the racetrack. So look, man, I worked on restrooms. I worked on concession stands. I once designed a transporter garage. But then the cool stuff is that I was able to spearhead and lead the initial installation in 1997, 98, 99 of 18 video boards at the time. It was unheard of to have 18 large screen video displays, or jumbotrons, as most people call them, around the facility like Indianapolis. And then after that came the audio system. And then somewhere in there, we also did tire barriers and we did rumble strips and we did all these things. And essentially, to fast forward and bring this full circle, that's what racetrack engineering is. When we created racetrack engineering, the idea was, let's take everything we learned at Indianapolis, let's take the ideology and the thought process of the Indianapolis, and let's give that to the rest of the industry, right? Most people can't afford a Kevin Forbes. So what we're going to do is we're going to be a miniature version of Kevin Forbes. We'll never be as great as Kevin. But what we're going to do is we're going to implore the resources and the people we have to help the industry to breathe new life and new technology and new innovation and new ideas into the industry. And, that was 2005, 2006. So 15 years later, I'm really proud of what we've been able to do in the industry.
Dave Dusick joins us here on Inside Open Wheel from Racetrack Engineering. Now, fast forward to today, you're still working with different racetracks. You're also working with different race series. When did the idea to start working with IndyCar, IMSA, traveling as, you're basically the replay officials, when did that come to fruition?
So it's funny, a lot of people, young people ask me, they want to get involved and they want to do things in the sport. And everybody asks, how does that happen? And several years ago, I was on a radio interview and somebody asked me, and off the cuff, I just said, my answer is always yes. If somebody calls and asks me, the answer is yes. And so essentially, Indianapolis installed the first camera system in the United States in the year 2000, and that was a requirement of the FIA in order to bring Formula One back for the United States Grand Prix in the year 2000. And within it's probably 18 to 24 months, I sort of slid into the role of operator of that camera system. And so I worked in that room. I was the guy who ran the camera system. And then I kind of became the liaison between the racetrack and the sanctioning body. And my responsibilities just sort of grew. And it was great experience because I got to work with IndyCar and NASCAR and Formula One and MotoGP and all these different race directors and sanctioning bodies. And the things I learned from these race directors was remarkable. But then you fast forward, as people started developing their own technology, they needed somebody to manage and understand how to operate these systems. And since I was the only guy in the country who had ever done that job, I was the person they called. And then it just sort of snowballed from there. And then our partnership with IndyCar and then IMSA, that led to the growth of our own technology. What we learned is we operated these systems for IndyCar and IMSA, and we said, man, these are great, but they're too expensive for the average everyday series. They're too expensive for the F3, F4 series. They're too expensive for SRO, PWC. They're too expensive for Road Dandy standalones. So we went out and started creating technology that gets you 60 to 80% of the way there for, say, 10 to 20% of the cost. And what that does is that creates consistency in your officiating. So you go race with IndyCar, you have technology. You go to a standalone, you still have some technology. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense because, you have the TV cameras, but a lot of places people don't realize that they're spaced far apart, that sometimes you get some of those dead zones. Like, well, for example, let's use Road America as an example. Between turn 3 and turn 5, it's a pretty long distance, and you might have a little dead zone right around the Sargento Bridge, so you have more cameras in different spaces, and you can go back easily without having to go to a director and say, hey, I need you to replay this because, this happened with this car. And they may not get it.
That, that, That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Basically, the systems that IndyCar and IMSA use and the systems that we've created for the second tier series, what we do is, if you watch a broadcast, an IndyCar race, an IMSA race, a NASCAR race, there may be anywhere between 20 and 40 different television cameras to cover that race. And there's a director choosing which camera he wants to look at next. What we do is we take all of those feeds discreetly. So we take all 40 feeds, and now we don't have to rely upon the director. We record every feed, and we can replay every feed discreetly, so that when something happens in turn three, even if TV missed it the first time, we've got it and we can go review it, and we don't have to wait for the director. And so what it really does is you're taking the same amount of information, but now you're splitting it up, and you have a produced feed that's for the fans, for those of you at home to enjoy the race. But then you also have all the information for the officials to make better informed decisions. And then the second part of that, of course, is to your point, when you have gaps in television coverage, we have dedicated pan tilt zoom cameras that we install to pick up those gaps. And actually, you'll see that in the IndyCar races, where sometimes TV doesn't have footage of an incident, but we have it in race control because IndyCar deploys their own cameras that TV doesn't get to see. So it's quite remarkable. Just like in stick and ball sports, car racing has understood that information is key, and you have to have all of it in order to make informed decisions.
And also, I think that's great as well, because, you know, you have three officials. We'll use IndyCar as an example. So you have the race director and two driver liaisons, for those who don't know. So, say, for example, there's a problem in, let's use the Arenas VK incident at Texas. Say, for example, the camera is watching the lead over in turn three and turn four. Okay, Arenas VK spins in turn two. TV doesn't have it because they're still focused on what's going on in three and four. Okay, you guys have a backstretch camera. Race control dials that up. Instead, boom, we have the incident, we have the ruling. And I feel also that rulings are a little bit faster now with that system.
Absolutely, 100%. To your point, the difference is the TV cameras move a lot, and the ovals are a perfect example where the TV cameras are focused on whatever TV is talking about. The cameras that we install, or in this case, the cameras that IndyCar installs, these PTVs, they're static. They don't move. And so what we do is we cover the entire racetrack, so we're sure to have the footage in case, you know, in case TV misses it. But to your point, that's what this is all about. Is it's about making better, more informed decisions quicker. And here's a good example. And I don't want to upset any of my corner worker friends, because we have a great relationship with our corner worker friends. I know. But the truth is, when you do things the way that we've done it forever, there's a telephone game. The corner worker has to be articulate enough to be able to do three things at once. He's got to wave a flag, he's got to pay attention to what's going on the track, and he's got to use his other hand to try to describe what he just saw back to the race director so adequately that the race director can understand exactly what's happening and make a decision. So these corner workers are amazing to me. What they do and how they can do three things at once in the line of fire, you know, with all this noise and cars, is remarkable. All our technology does is augment that. And it says, okay, the corner worker calls it in. Without the corner worker, we don't necessarily know what's going on down there. The corner worker calls it in. Now we spin a camera around, we zoom in. Now the race director, as the corner worker is telling us what's going on, the race director can see it with his own eyes. So it speeds up the telephone game, if you will. It speeds up the transfer of information. And now the race director can make a faster, better, more informed decision. And at the end of the day, that's good for two things. It's good for safety, because if you're in trouble, the race director can get people to you faster. And two, the sooner we make decisions, the sooner we get cleaned up, which means we maximize track time, which is the most important thing for most of these mid-level series, right?
Mm-hmm. It really is. And you actually have a fantastic group of individuals that work with not only you and the series, but work with you, you know, in general, to make Racetrack Engineering, in my opinion, one of the best companies in the world to actually work with. And this is not a paid ads segment. I can tell you that right now. And like I said, I've known Dave for a decade, so I've seen the growth within Racetrack Engineering over the past 10 years.
Yeah, well, is this a paid advertisement, or is this a segue into a job interview? Either one, I'll take both.
I wish either way, you know. But anyway, you still have a lot of great individuals who work with you, you know, who are some who just, you know, started out with you, or some who've worked in the industry for years, and they become the forefront of motorsports technology and safety.
Well, I'm glad you bring this up, because we're working with a marketing company to really try to help understand who we are. And, you know, the whole growth of RTE has been organic. And so now that we're here, we're trying to figure out how to explain who we are and continue that growth. And the thing that's really important is, while I'm the face of RTE, it is all the people behind this. And it's not just the current, it's all the people who got us to this place. I don't know if you're 100% aware, Jeremy, but we've sort of scaled back our roadshow operations, and we actually we gave up the IMSA and IndyCar contracts recently, and so now our alumni are actually working directly for the series. And we did that because we're an innovation company. Once the technology is stabilized, you know, we're not a staffing agency. We don't need to just send people for the sake of sending people. So we're transitioning into this innovation role. So what we have is, we have this long list of alumni, people who are part of our family. And I'm very grateful and proud to see those alumni go and succeed beyond. And I'm grateful and proud to have seen the people who started and got their start with RTE and moved on. Because I started in the sport as a young man, a very young kid. And I had a lot of people put their arm around my shoulder and drag me and say, come on, kid, you know, we're going to do this together. And so if nothing else, just the fact that we're able to do that for other people. And we're talking about the Zach Taskers, and we've got a young lady by the name of Ashley Keller, who's now a PR and marketing girl in the MHRA. And then you've got, you know, Brooke Schumann, Brooke Rowden, and Will Curry, who's now in Nashville, and all these people who are doing great things, who their first job in the sport was with us. And that's definitely the thing I'm most proud, because at the end of the day, the sport is about people. And it's great to know that we have good people in the sport that kind of grew their wings here at RTE.
All right, so now that a lot of these racetracks and race series are kind of limiting their footprint because of COVID-19 and, you know, trying to stop the spread, how does Racetrack Engineering, you know, as a company, where do you come in?
So that's an interesting question. And to be honest, what I think has happened is, I saw a vision for the industry, and I saw an idea that spectator driven motorsport, we're going to see a decline. We already know it, right? The marketplace is crowded in the entertainment sector, and at track attendance is something that may not, you know, especially in the big leagues, we may not see the numbers we've seen in the past. COVID-19 has expedited that. And it basically, it created a shelf, right? Overnight, all of a sudden, there were no fans at racetracks. Now, luckily, as we start to open back up, the fans are coming back in droves because they miss car racing. But to answer your question, that's really important, because think of it this way. In the old days, you went to a racetrack and you had a PA system and maybe a scoreboard. And then you had a PA system and a video board. And then maybe you had a scanner. And now what we're transitioning towards is, we're transitioning towards all the information on your handheld device, right? We all live on our phones all day long. Apple tells me every week how many hours I spend on my phone, and it's sickening. And so to answer your question, that's the next step. What we've realized is, we're creating content. At this racetrack down here, actually it's a private circuit down here in Miami, the Concours Club, we installed 21 timelines, and we have 26 cameras around the racetrack. All of a sudden, we are now a giant producer of content. And so while we use that information to be able to manage the racetrack and what happens between the guardrails, why not take that information and feed it to the members? And so when you zoom that back out to a racetrack, that's what's going to happen, Jeremy, is you're going to have what we call a circuit feed. You saw that with the Road to Indy this year, where we used our cameras and actually created a live feed. The folks at Road to Indy TV did a great job. We're also working on some pretty new slick technology with Race Monitor and MyLapse on the timing feed stuff. And so what you're going to get is, you're going to get technology that's in your hand. And if you're at the track, now you're a more informed viewer at the track. But if you're not at the track, now you can get that same experience away from the track as if you're at the track. And so it's not a virtual event, but what it is just the spread of information to a larger mass of people so that you can follow the events that you enjoy, even if you can't make it there in person.
Well, Dave, I've watched, like I said, I've watched your stuff. I've actually had the opportunity to call, you know, an event or two with your technology. So it's great for somebody who's an announcer, somebody who's a corner worker and a former race official myself. You know, it's great technology. Great to see we're actually bringing it now towards your semi-pro series. How can fans watch? Because I know sometimes you do post on the Racetrack Engineering social media sites. How can fans watch what you're doing? What's coming next?
Absolutely. RT is on the big three socials, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's at Racetrack Engineering, all one word. And yeah, follow along. And more importantly, give us feedback. If your favorite racetrack, if the PA system needs a little work, or if you think they need a scoreboard, or if you're a corner worker and you think that safety lights would be critical in a dangerous corner, like, we're not here to sell products. We're here to solve problems. We're here to make this industry better. Our motto is, if the industry thrives, we too shall thrive. We want to help this industry. So what we love about engaging with our fans and race fans is, look, help us, be our eyes, be our ears, go out into the industry, find areas where we can grow and we can evolve, and bring them to us, and we'll help you do that.
Dave, thanks as always for joining us. It's always great talking to you. I know we can talk more, but we'll schedule another time where you and I can sit down and chat with the fans about, you know, what's next for Racetrack Engineering.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for the time and the opportunity. As you can tell, I love talking racetracks and technology. And always good to catch up, buddy. It's great to hear from you.
Always great to hear from you as well. Coming up next is our F4 FR America's season review on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, here's the first of our two series we're covering today. It's F4, and as always, we bring our F4 FR America's analyst, Eric Brennan, joins us. And Eric, it was a truncated season, obviously, because of COVID. I'm going to say that everywhere, so get used to it, folks. It is what it is. But nonetheless, I don't think that this season lacked on, can I say, excitement.
No, not at all. And I will tell you, I had a chance to say a couple of words at the season-ending awards banquet. And one of the points I wanted to stress from everybody, top to bottom, no matter where you finish the point standings, was everybody has a lot to be proud of just to get to the racetrack. And I know that, you know, as you said in your lead into this question, that's the theme across every racing series. And I don't want it to go unnoticed for every team and organization, even, you know, especially looking at the FRA guys, who a lot of those teams had to deviate their plans 2 months before what turned out to be the FRA season opener. Just to have the series put on the show that they did, it being as exciting and competitive as it was an incredible bonus. But for everybody to be able to make sure that checks cleared, haulers got on the road, you know, deals were signed, equipment was in place, parts were on order. It was a lot of moving and shaking by a lot of different people. And it goes across the board from the SCCA to the series team owners, to the drivers, to the families, to whatever travel agents they may end up having to use in order to reroute themselves when the schedule kept getting an egg beater put to it. The good news is, the plus side is, the on-track product was thrilling and incredible, especially once we got into a little bit of a groove and we knocked some of the rust off from the Mid-Ohio stint, which, you know, of course, we had to kick off a delayed season where there was all this pent-up energy and angst and everybody was so eager to go. And then, of course, it downpours to just kind of give us the perfect storm for a bit of chaos. But once we got that in the rearview mirror, things rolled on pretty smoothly. And yeah, I'd say the level of excitement and entertainment was at a peak pretty much all season long.
33 cars started off at Mid-Ohio. And of course, it was the inaugural viewing for FanRacing.live. So a lot of big things happened. It was also an SVRA weekend, so track time was at a premium. A lot of newness to this season. We saw, a lot of great storylines early on. Of course, the first race waved off because of that downpour. Race number two, I got to zoom in here because I don't have supersonic sight, but race number two, that was interesting in and of itself because it came with, can we say, some controversy near the end of the weekend?
Oh, yeah. And this is kind of, I want to say, the dark point of the season. And it's not because of the infractions that were found, but it's just, you know, everybody, I mean, NASCAR's had this issue. For years, they would not take a win away from a driver because they didn't want the fans who left the racetrack, or anybody who left the racetrack, to leave not knowing who won. They would issue penalties if somebody was found to be in violation or infraction of any sort of rule, you know, or gray area. But usually whoever took the checkered flag first would keep top honors. And obviously in these developmental series where your racing resume is so important, you know, you just simply can't do that. So the Jay Howard driver development deal, which impacted Christian Bogle, who is a great person, and Jay Howard himself is an incredible person. He provides a lot of opportunities for people within the sport. I actually saw that this weekend they got cars out where young Jackson Lee is getting a testing opportunity in one of the Road to Indy platforms. And he, too, was fielding a number of efforts in F4, and they came out of the gate strong. They ran very well in both rounds of Mid-Ohio, even though the first one didn't count for championship points you mentioned. Bogle led from wire to wire, basically backed up the rain-shortened victory he took on day one, and they found that a part was not in compliance with the SEC rulebook. Howard and company did fight that for quite a long time. It actually went through a couple of appeals boards, and it really wasn't until we got locked and unloaded at our second stop of the season at VIR that we were made aware that, you know, the penalties were going to be upheld. They were going to stand, and Howard was going to have some pretty heavy – he's going to have some pretty heavy fines to pay out. And, you know, we didn't want to start the season on that level of – or on that type of a note, I should say. Worked out, though, for Dylan Tavella, because that's what, you know, Inep gave him his first win of the season and what would turn out to be a very strong start of the season for Tavella. And it also improved the finishing result of Hunter Yaney, who, even though he was credited with top honors due to the DQ on day one, you know, the points didn't come with it. But as we'll see later on, it didn't happen to matter. But it was definitely a sour note to start off the F4 season for sure.
And that's when Hunter Yaney really took off at the next weekend at VIR. We saw him win two out of the three. Dylan Tavella won the second race. That race had some interesting action. We saw a rollover. We saw some just some interesting action at VIR. And the reason why we say that is because you don't normally see open wheel racing at VIR.
Yeah, and I wish we did. Yeah. After being able to be there that weekend and seeing a part of it, I don't know why, but it's old school. For me, my first experience as a fan of ever seeing anything happening at VIR was when the then Rolex sports cars were there in the mid-2000s. Oh. That was when I was first opened to this beautiful and incredible facility. You're right, though. It was wild, but it seemed to be a fun track. Everybody I talked to in the pit area said that they actually love being a part of it. One of the main reasons is that long back straightaway where they start to climb uphill just a little bit. It's right after you come off for turn 12 of the Oak Tree turn. And they say they feel like they're about to blast off into space by the time they hit the end of that straightaway. But you're right. We did see some pretty hair-raising accidents, one of which we didn't catch. Actually, I believe it was Alex Morton and another car actually hit the pit attenuator barrier early on in the weekend. In fact, Josh Sarche showed me a still image of it that was floating around. I'm not sure if you had a chance to see it. If not, I'll do my best.
I did, yeah.
That was one of those, like, how do we miss that? You know, but it happened to be at an area, you know, their front straightaway kind of curves the driver's right a little bit after you come off the last corner. And I guess we didn't have somebody placed at that area and we totally ended up missing it. But, as you mentioned, though, it started to paint this picture, which I thought was going to carry on all season long between Yaney and Tavella. I thought that was going to be the rivalry and that was going to be the feud that we were going to have to keep our eyes on, as they had come close to making contact a couple times that weekend. And it looked like these were going to be the guys who were going to trade, you know, top honors at top of the win column and the point standings. And that's what the stage was kind of set from the VIR perspective going forward.
I actually got a VIR story. We're going to deviate off F4 a little bit because I just thought of this. The second time I was at VIR was the final ALMS sprint race in history. I was with the support series at the time as their PR. And, you know, I'm watching the ALMS race, and that's when they had that massive GTC crash where the car rolled and ended up on top of the tire barriers in front of the camera. I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, oh, well, that sucks. You know, hopefully everybody's okay. Next morning, I get a text from my mom. So, were you going to tell me about the crash? What crash? She goes, I saw Good Morning America. I saw the Porsche crash. You going to tell me about that? I go, yeah, it happened. I was in the paddock. Why? She goes, oh, that wasn't you that was operating the camera there. I go to my wife at the time because she was down with me as my media assistant because it was a pro weekend, so I needed somebody as my assistant. I show her that. She goes, "Did you really think you were manning the cameras?" I go, "Did you really think I was going to man any camera?" So, yeah, that's my VIR story. Very beautiful facility. It was also the place where first time we were there, they had pulled pork. So I'm like, well, I'm at a racetrack in the South. I've got to have the pulled pork. So I get there, and our photog's like, "You're not going to have barbecue sauce on." I go, "If I'm going to try some barbecue, I don't want any sauce to neuter it, and I want to try it as is. Good barbecue doesn't need sauce." And the cook behind, she goes, "Damn right."
Yeah, it's an interesting place for sure.
It is.
The setup there and the museum that they have at that place as well, that where they have pictures of just dating all the way back to the track's inception. Just an unbelievable facility.
It's a great facility. Make it a stop on your bucket list, because I love going to VIR. All right, Barber Motorsports Park. 4 races that weekend. It was a very busy weekend. And that's about the time we saw that Hunter Yaney could be our championship contender, the championship contender, after his strong finishes.
Yeah, and I will tell you, Barber is where we shifted into another gear.
Yeah.
If you go back and look at the results of the stat sheets on a website, you'll see that we were under the yellow flag for a large percentage of on-track time. Especially, you mentioned the fact that Mid-Ohio, which is something that the series may end up, having to deal with going forward with their new partnership with SVRA and Trans Am for a lot of races they're going to be at next year, is the amount of track time. The schedule was so tight at Mid-Ohio, it really didn't allow a lot of wiggle room. That's why races were shortened. That's why, the decision to stop with rain tires on, put them in a little bit of a box. Well, once we got to Barber, it was pretty much our track. We were paired up as well with the Radical Cup North America guys, but there was so much flexibility in the schedule that Scott Goodyear and his officiating team were able to build this 1 hour time window over the 30 minutes of race time that the drivers were allotted in the event of a crash. That way, if a driver had an incident or a wreck, because let's face it, it doesn't do these drivers any good riding behind the pace car for, let's call it 50% of their 30-minute race. They're not learning anything. So they decided to put this one-hour blanket over the time frame of the race, and it actually paid off. It did come into play a couple of times. I believe it was the first race on each day. We ran 2 on Saturday, 2 on Sunday, where we did have 2 red flags as a result of cautions. And in some of these cases, it was just a single-car spin where a guy stalled or a car that broke down or was stationary on the exit of one of the corners. And it would have just eaten up so much track time. You should figure one lap under yellow at Barber is just under 4 minutes of race time. So having the availability to do that really started to increase the entertainment value and also the skill level of some of these drivers. And Barber was just that. And it was proven in the finishes. I think the largest margin of victory we had on the end of the weekend was just over about 0.2 of a second. We had one race that I think finished under yellow that Hunter Yaney ended up winning. But the rest of them were nail biters, and they were absolute thrillers. And it was the first time that we had a new winner besides that of Yaney and Tavella, as Jose Blanco finally got the monkey off his back, and he had an opportunity to taste victory. And Spike Kolbecker, also a Crosslink Kiwi, got his first victory of the weekend as well. And Sam Paley came inches close of getting the job done the first time there. But we left Barber with 4 thrillers, 4 winners so far in the season, and Hunter Yaney starting to take full control of the series.
Yeah, and I've got to say, that was, I think, the best move of the season by Scott Goodyear to say, hey, all right, here's your block. Whatever we get in, we get in, because there were so many races in those first couple rounds where they would be under the yellow for over half of the race. You wouldn't see it in FR Americas. You'd see it in F4, and that was a talking point that either you or I had, or you or someone else and I had about... No, I remember what it was. It was with someone within the series we were talking, and they said, with the amount of money that you're paying, you can go to USF 2000 or Indy Pro 2000 and, get the same, if not more, amount of track time. But these guys aren't doing this in practice. They're only doing this in the race. So, kudos to Scott Goodyear and the crew for stepping up and saying, okay, this is your lot of time. If we get this in, great. If we don't, well, that's what you get.
Yeah. And I mean, it worked, The thing is, they've also started to really try to push a lot of these teams to take advantage of some of the on-track programs that are available to them in the off-calendar months. In fact, the series just put out a press release, I believe it was last week, where they showed all the regional series that develop in the winter in some cases. I know you've had Gustavo Yakiman on, but his academy that kicks off on the southeastern part of the states, they've already begun some of their testing programs for some of those events as well. It's hard to take some of these drivers who either come up straight from karting or from another discipline of motorsports that doesn't have the level of consequences or the competitive nature of racing on track that F4 can provide. Also, with the equipment being so equal across a number of different disciplines and platforms in F4, as far as the motor, the tire supplier, as well as the chassis, obviously you see the cream rise to the top in terms of teams, but, with the playing field being as level as it is, it provides these drivers a chance to think that they just need to be as aggressive as possible to get to the front. It doesn't always pan out that way. And track time it's pivotal, especially for the development of these drivers who are trying to get somewhere in their career in X amount of years. So providing that red flag window, I'm with you. That is probably one of the best moves that had been made by any race director in any series across 2020, bar none, because it paid off and it continued. I think that decision and that opportunity of, allowing more driver time under green is what truly allowed the season to continue out as it went to Florida for Sebring and Homestead and eventually COTA for the rest of the year.
Yeah, we had the doubleheader weekends at Sebring and Homestead. That's right, where Hunter Yaney took the broom out, swept the three races. And at that point, the world was his oyster for F4 going into Homestead. But that almost didn't happen. There was one record that Yaney was going for at Homestead. We saw it end coming off of the oval near the end of the third race.
Yeah, I mean, Sebring box score tells you Hunter Yaney made that his house. Mm-hmm. The one story that the Sebring, we may not be able to totally be able to tell by just looking at the results, but man, Jose Blanco was quick. I mean, and obviously he crashed hard while going for the lead. Actually, first race had to start in the pit lane due to a technical error by the team. Finished second by inches. Second race, while battling for the lead, crashes hard in turn one. And they just never rebounded. So Yaney took full advantage, and that's what put him in position to potentially win at just about every racetrack that the series would stop on. And he had a chance to do just that. And ironically, he was battling for the lead with Jose Blanco coming off that back straightaway when they tangled. And Yaney came across the line first. It was announced a little bit later, again, because it had to go through the process in which the governing body that the SCCA has in place, that Yaney would be handed, I believe it was a 5-second penalty. It did knock him down to third. Blanco somehow drove all the way up through the pack to finish second, and Eric Evans was able to celebrate a victory. VRD still kept the trophy. It just went from one driver to the other. But even with that result, Yaney was able to seal the championship and became the youngest F4 champion ever in series history. And very impressive for a driver who would openly tell you that he was not that good of a kart racer. Something about these full-body cars with seatbelts just suited his style. And as soon as we got underway back in mid-Ohio, he basically, took hold of the series and never looked back.
So he won the championship. There was some discussion on whether or not Hunter Yaney would be racing at COTA for F4. He ended up making the move to FR Americas. We'll talk about that in our FR Americas wrap-up. But at COTA, Jose Blanco showed that if he stays in F4, he's going to be the man to beat. Two wins out of three. Spike Hulbecker with the second win, sandwiching the middle. That race wasn't short on action either.
Oh, and COTA, it doesn't seem to ever disappoint with F4. And I think it has to be the fact that many of these drivers want to find a way to get it to F1. Now, granted, that's a flooded funnel to try to filter your way through. But, every driver is in F1 now. They were one day in these racers' shoes with those dreams and aspirations, and they made it happen. And I wouldn't put it past the number of competitors we have in the F4 field to have that opportunity as well. And to race on a track like Circuit of the Americas, which just takes your breath away as you're pulling into the main entrance off the highway outside the facility, it means a lot to them. For Blanco, though, you have to wonder what could have been. If knowing how dominant he was on the weekend and how well he was running there, even though he didn't sweep the weekend, he still had one of the fastest cars all throughout. I think differing and changing weather conditions is what caught him out from the sweep, as we went from very, uncharacteristic like temperatures for Austin, Texas for that time of the year, and cloud cover to having the sunshine over the racing facility, where he just seemed to settle in and the team hit the nail on the head as far as setup was concerned. And he ended the season on a high note by capturing the season finale. But you have to wonder what could have been for him if he was able to rack up the results, maybe even get that win over Yaney back at Sebring, maybe avoid making contact with the barrier and salvage a points paying finish. It just appeared that he got hot too late in the season and had a couple of mistakes in the Florida stints of races that took him out of contention. He was one of the returning veterans, though. Him and Dylan Tavella had experience back in 2019 in that four. I hope they come back for another year, because I think that those two have matured into true championship title contenders. VRD is supposed to field Eric Evans for his full season. Also, they signed on a new driver as well that we talked about on a prior episode, and a Legend Car driver, Jason Alder. So the field is going to be stacked for 2021, and I really hope that Blanco and Tavella are on the entry blanks as well once it comes time to kick off the next season.
Yeah, it's interesting to see these driver signings here in the next couple of days. Also, Ryan Yardley racing with Crosslink. That's going to be interesting. He did do quite well at, I'm not going to say it's the F4 West. It's one of the Formula Car regional series, but they do run F4 equipment over at California Speedway. We were supposed to have someone on and talk about that, but unfortunately we were tight for time already today. But so there's going to be a lot of talent in F4 next year. Hang tight. We're going to get back to you in a little bit, Eric, but joining us right here after this break will be a couple of members talking about the... Let me redo that one. All right, hang tight real quick, Eric, because coming up next, Mike Marini is going to join us. Some big news coming out of both Formula Regional Americas and Indy Lights. Two powerhouses combined as one here on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
I do want to apologize to FRP. We will do their season review in December, but we do have some big news that came through the Road to Indy pipeline, more namely within the Indy Lights pipeline. So the story came through on Tuesday. Global Racing Group enters Indy Lights, presented by Cooper Tires, in a breakthrough partnership with HMD Motorsports. If you remember, earlier in the season, both teams were 1-2 within the FR Americas Championship. This is even with HMD Motorsports coming in as a relative new team to FR Americas after Indy Lights ceased operations for the 2020 season. But they're back together for 2021. Joining me with both teams, really, is Mike Marini. Mike, thanks for taking the time. And this is some monumental news for not only Junior Formula Motorsports, but it's also monumental news for both teams.
Yes. It's 2020 has been a difficult year for everybody. So we decided to try and end it off with some good news, and definitely looking forward to 2021.
All right, now let's talk about how the deal came together with both teams competing against each other. This almost has like a Newman Haas sort of feel to it from the late 70s.
Well, honestly, I mean, HMD Motorsports entered FR Americas about 2 hours after Indy Lights got canceled. I received a phone call from Dan Anderson personally that told he mentioned to me what was happening with the Indy Lights series. We hung up the phone from him, and within 2 hours, we had acquired the first FR car. Within 2 or 3 days, we had acquired the second one, and then grew throughout the season to a four-car program. Obviously, Global was the benchmark in the series for the years, for the previous year. So it was just something that we always wanted to compete against the best, and we felt that that was the best program to enter, despite the circumstances of what was going on around the world. And as we went through the season, I mean, they had an incredible driver in Linus, and David Malukas was racing with him, and between the two of them, they managed to win every single race. And after second or third round, we just started talking and throwing around some ideas, and it was from a mutual connection that knew both teams, that kind of put Henry Malukas and Christian Pedersen together. And from that point on, there was a few meetings at Sebring, a few meetings at Homestead, progressed in Dakota, and basically we're here today.
And it's great because it's going to be a four-car operation, two with HMD, and then two with the, you know, the Global Racing Group partnership. We already know that obviously David Malukas is going to be running in one of those seats, as we saw how quick he was in that first practice at St. Petersburg earlier this year. But can we divulge into anyone else filling those seats right now?
Well, we had we literally tested Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. So I got home late last night. We had three cars on track at the Homestead Miami Speedway. We picked up a few pieces that were needed for the fourth car. If you look through on social media, everybody can tell that Rasmus Lind was one of the drivers that was testing. We don't have any. Basically, we have made no driver announcements yet so far. We are working on trying to finalize all four in advance of making those announcements. But yeah, we're definitely working in the right direction to have four cars, trying to have everything done and locked and loaded by December 10th for all four drivers. We do have another test scheduled for the 14th and 15th at Sebring. We're also talking about going out west in early January. Before we have the halos installed. So it's a busy time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you guys got to get those new titanium halos put on all four cars. So it is a busy time. In what direction are we looking at in the future, especially with this coming season? Are crews procured? Any big names that will be engineering the car?
Yep. Well, the HMD Motorsports crew hasn't changed from 2019. Honestly, it's... at the end of 2019, there were some pretty significant changes. There was a good Indy Lights crew that was put together. That same Indy Lights crew that started St. Pete stayed together all year. And to make a long story short, we went through a global pandemic, or we're going through a global pandemic. And Henry Malukas committed to all the employees that, hey, we're going to go back Indy Lights racing in 2021. So we're all going to work in 2020. We're going to go to the FR Americas program, even though it's less income. Every mechanic still was on staff. They still got paid. Everything moved forward as it was, as there was no hiccups going on in the world. So I think there's some loyalty there on both sides. The mechanics, the crew were very loyal to stay with Henry because nobody really knew what was going on in the world. Henry was very loyal to make sure those people got paid. Now you bring Christian from Global into the program, and I think you solidify a top-notch, top-tier team with good personnel and strong everybody working in one direction to go in the right direction. The goal for 2021 is, everybody knows that there's been one team that's been dominating for quite some time, and the goal is to enter the series and beat them. And that's simple. That's the goal. Engineering, Yancey. Yancey was Renus's engineer in 2019. He was with David throughout FR Americas this year. He was with, we did a lot of Indy Lights testing at the end of 2019, leading into 2020. He will be David's engineer. We have Nathan Toney. Nathan was with, he's been with HMD for the past 6 months. He's with some other programs before that. He was Rasmus's engineer at Ballardi for the start of the St. Pete weekend in 2020. Jumped around a little bit. Now he's found a home at HMD. He's a great guy, a good friend of mine too. But he is, he's quite knowledgeable and pretty switched on when everything comes down to it. So he's definitely one of our top guys. AJ Smith is the team manager. He's in charge of the equipment, the personnel inside the shop. We have five or six full-time employees at the shop, mechanics now. So it's a growing program. There's four cars confirmed. There's a possibility of some additional stuff going on. And then this whole program, this partnership with Global and the partnership with HMD, there's going to be some other stuff announced in the future. But we just have to get over the hump and get the season started.
Now, how much of the equipment has been procured from the closing Ballardi?
Nothing.
Okay.
We, HMD Motorsports actually purchased a few small pieces, nothing at all to run. We didn't need it. It was kind of purchased for some spare stuff. All four cars are in the shop, all the equipment's in the shop, scale pads, you know, tuggers, all that kind of stuff. Everything is ready to go.
Now, I know you and I have talked about this through emails. Does this affect anything that goes on with FR Americas for either team right now?
Well, I can't speak for Christian and Global, but I do know in conversation with him, he's interested in running the series, committed to running the series. He's been their team has been the team to beat. So
right.
To leave that would be, I mean, he runs his global program, but I think he will be he will continue on with that. He will be a huge success in that, and that would be what everybody hopes for. I think the format that we've kind of laid out within the two organizations and the one partnership. Obviously, the Road to Indy has scholarships that move people up to Indy Lights. FR Americas has scholarships that move people up to Indy Lights. So now together, we basically have the best of both worlds to pull from those drivers. A couple of the drivers that we're working with, they're multi-year programs. So they're not just going to be a one and done type of deal. So if they're third, fourth, fifth, second in the championship, and they don't have the chance to move up to IndyCar, you're likely going to see some of those names return in 2022, which in my opinion only makes the series stronger.
Yeah.
HMD will focus on Indy Lights completely. There's no FR Americas HMD team anymore. The equipment, one of the cars was sold, a couple of the cars were customer cars. But the goal is to focus on Indy Lights, advanced drivers to IndyCar. And if we can take drivers once they're done on the FR side of the program with Christian at Global, and we can pull them into the Indy Lights program and they see some familiar faces in the partnership, then we call that a success.
Mike Marini joins me here on Inside Open, where we're talking about the HMD Global Racing Group pairing in Indy Lights for next season. It's going to be a four-car combined team with two HMD, Global Racing Group HMD cars. And I want to talk real quick about Henry Malukas. Being somebody from the Chicagoland area, I'm used to seeing the HMD trucks. So what is the story for those who are not aware about who Henry Malukas is? What's his backstory?
He owns the trucking company out of Chicago, a pretty large truck company. They run trucks all over the United States. He's got trucks on the road. I mean, if you don't notice them and you look for them, once you see one, you see a lot. Especially in and around the Midwest. I mean, I was at lunch the other day and I looked out the window and an HMD truck drove by. Like that's just, it's kind of, and you don't notice it. They're not, the logo doesn't jump out at you or it's not a fancy truck that it's, but I mean, you see it and you see the logo on the race team, you see the logo on the car on the truck. And then, there's a lot of business to business stuff behind the scenes that I help him with and he helps me with, I guess you could say. Same with Christian. I think there's a huge business to business effort behind it. This is more about, obviously we have to win on track. We have to look great off the track, but it's also about how we pay for all this stuff. And I think with the combined effort and having a name in an FR program and a combined name in an Indy Lights program, we can bring more bang for the buck or value for the dollar, however you want to call it, to any sort of partner that's involved.
Yeah, it's going to be great because you take a look, Andretti's already said they're going to have four. They already have at least one driver signed in Kyle Kirkwood. You guys have four. So we're already about the quote-unquote average field from 18 to 19 in Indy Lights.
Yeah, and I think this will be the biggest year it has been in the past 3, 4, 5 years. I think you're going to see Jay Howard they have access to two cars. I know the Bilardi equipment, if that is going to get sold or if it hasn't been sold, I don't really know the story behind it, but I knew there was a bunch of people looking at it. So if that gets into the right hands, those two cars will be on the grid. Obviously having Stingray Rob win the Indy Pro Championship and him being with the Junkos family, a Junkos program there, hopefully that's a done deal to move him up to Indy Lights. And if you have one car in the trailer, you might as well have two. So if they can put another car on the grid, I mean, I'm expecting 13 to 15, and I would be surprised and shocked if it's less than 13. But I think you're going to see 14 or 15 on the grid in St. Pete.
Yeah, I think that's a very generous. I'm not going to say generous is a bad thing. I think it's a very generous number. I would like to see more, but I think the more people I talk to, that's the number that they're saying it's 15. 15 is the average number, and I'm real happy to see that because it's been a while since we've seen really Indy Lights or Atlantics back, 10 years ago have that many cars in the field.
Right. Yeah, and between after we had a few drivers before the announcement, I would say five or six drivers. Now after the announcement went out, we've kind of been flooded with emails and phone calls, and there's eight or nine kind of on the list that they want to do some testing, and they want sample contracts and stuff like that. So it's very positive because let's just say HMD runs four cars and there's nine drivers looking. That means that there's five drivers that can go elsewhere,
yeah.
In a polite way. I guess I'm saying that, but it also gives the opportunity for more teams, what the whole goal of the program is to advance drivers to IndyCar. Mm-hmm. And if we can pull these drivers into the Indy Lights program, whether they come from Europe, North America, or anywhere else in the world, I mean, that's just the whole idea is to have a healthy grid.
And one final question. Any of these drivers you're looking at have a scholarship? Because we know one of those drivers, as I just mentioned, already signed on with the team.
There's scholarships out there that come from many different series. So obviously the FR Americas champion last year raced with Global Racing Group, Linus, and if he does get in an Indy Lights car this year, he's an incredible talent. And let's just say, we'd rather have him on our team than race against him. But with that being said, you have to explore the options with every driver, and every driver has to explore the options with every team. So, I would be surprised if he is not on the grid. But I hope we're racing with him and not against him.
All right. I wouldn't be a good journalist if I didn't ask that question. Mike Marini, thanks for joining us. And I'm really excited. This is going to be so fun this next season, Indy Lights.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, Eric Brennan joins us for FR America's wrap-up from the 2020 season.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Eric Brennan joins me. We're talking about Formula Regional America's 2020 season this time. And I'm going to preface this by saying this. If you look at the results, you see one guy winning all but one or two races. But that's not the whole story. We'll talk more about that, but I want to touch on a little bit of the interview with Mike Marini. And Eric, unfortunately, it kind of confirms what we somewhat knew, that HMD Motorsports isn't going to be back next year. We had a feeling that was going to happen. What does this do to the FR Americas field, even though VRD we know is going to have at least one car next season?
I will tell you, I'm worried. I'm worried for the car count perspective. I'm afraid it's going to take a step back to a couple seasons ago where they only, on average had about 7 to 9 cars out there, which, some people listening may say, oh, that's an Indy Lights field in 2019. And the problem is Indy Lights is going the opposite direction. And let's kind of call a spade here. A lot of the reason why we had Andretti Autosport, HMD, come on over and join us in the FRA contest this year was because Indy Lights was no longer an option. And even though, yes, it is incredibly lucrative for a team to compete in FRA, especially if the Indy Lights scholarship that Linus Lundqvist was able to capture by virtue of winning his championship this season, even if that does stick around for 2021, which I'm not sure about you. I haven't heard official confirmation of that just yet. But these teams were built and planning to go play in the minor league series of IndyCar. And it looks as though that Roger Penske is starting to, do a little bit of adjustments. Some teams, may love, some teams and drivers may not love, but it's with the benefit of the series as a whole in mind. And, hearing that HMD is going to head back on over to Indy Lights, not too surprised. The partnership with the Global Racing Group to make that possible with a 4-car entry. Curious if that's going to drain any resources from what was a 4-car, destination in FRA. Obviously, Linus is packing his bags and moving on up. And hopefully, James Rowe, Dario Cangelosi, and Nikki Hayes will be back with the team in FRA next season as well. But I'm a little bit concerned about how the entry lists are going to look, especially with the expanded schedule and, the more the wider ranging roadmap that they're going to be competing in with some very new and exciting venues. But I just hope the participation rate is what the series is hoping for.
Well, and it looks like that at least one new team will stay, and that's going to be in the form of Newman Wax Racing. But talk more about that. Start off at Mid-Ohio. Okay. We thought, okay, Dave Malukas, Victor Franzoni, you know, you had Daniel Frost, Santi Urrutia. It's like, okay, this is a decent field. It's going to be an interesting year. Who's this Elias Lundqvist guy? Oh, wait, he's up at the front.
Yeah, and that's really the crazy thing. Looking back on the season opener, which for me was exciting because it was my first chance to meet a lot of these drivers face-to-face. And then, of course, you know, David Malukas is here. Daniel Frost is here. Santiago Urruti is here. Like, these are guys that I've been watching for a few years now. Yeah. You know, Victor Franzoni is someone who I've been watching Indy Lights for a number of years. You know, just hasn't had another opportunity over the last couple seasons. And you're right. But at first, we're like, all right, well, it rained. You know, and Linus is from Sweden. It always rains over there. He's got wet weather experience. Like, okay, that's his thing. We'll see how he does in the dry. And then he came out and did it again. And he didn't just, you know, he didn't just beat a handful of kids who just came up from F4. He beat well-established open door racers, you know. And I think that was when everybody was like, uh-oh, you know, we got to figure this out. We got to pay more attention to this kid. And I think a lot of it started to turn into also, well, Global Racing Group has captured this championship the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they just got Mid-Ohio figured out. Then we go to VIR, and the trend continues. And then we started watching Linus in practice, and we started watching his approach on how he handles practice sessions and how he methodically climbs his way up the pylon. It didn't take very long to figure out that Linus was the special ingredient. Linus was the reason, not just his ability in the wet, you know, not just the team that he was with. He was the guy, and he ran that streak all the way up to the midpoint in the season. And it looked as though he was going to run the table for quite some time. But Mid-Ohio was a peak at the brilliance of what Linus Lundqvist was able to accomplish. And I want to just admit openly that we didn't give him full credit right off the gate. And in retrospect, we should have. But you can understand why we were a bit hesitant on, you know, beginning to welcome and embrace just how special of a talent this kid really is.
And not to mention, if you ever have a chance to listen back to our interviews with Linus, down to earth, one of the coolest cats out there in the paddock. Now, you and I, Eric, have throughout the past season, we've been able to talk to some of these kids, get to know them, get to know the personalities. They're all great, but I think Linus, for as much as he has won, just completely down to earth.
Oh yeah, and I'll tell you, you know, and not to skip too far ahead in our review here, but one of the most genuine things that I absolutely loved about Linus was at the very end of the season at the year-end award banquet. When he got up there to give his speech, a lot of drivers, and this is not taking anything away from some people because some people aren't good at speaking in front of a crowd. A lot of drivers had their notes written down, their sponsors written down. You know, they fully scripted their entire speech. Linus went up there off the cuff, looking at the entire room, embracing everybody, almost making eye contact with all 90 people that may have been in that bank room. May have probably been a little bit less, but they did all that they could to social distance properly, though, and everybody had a really great time. But he was shooting from the hip, and genuine. That's the best word for it. I think he hit the nail on the head there. You know, it's just such a genuine individual. And I went up to him afterwards, congratulated him on a great year. And it was as if we've known each other for years. And obviously we don't. He's just such a good guy. And as dominant as he is, he makes it hard to root against him sometimes, which is a very good thing. It's a very marketable skill to have as a race car driver. And that's why I'm not trying to overhype the kid en route to Indy Lights. I really think he's got everything he needs to get to the top and stay there.
Well, and of course, when we first talked, he said that, you know, he's got, you know, Marcus Ericsson and Felix Rosenqvist. So that helps, too, to have people that you know in the series. So we'll talk more about that a little bit later on. I want to get to VIR because, as we said, with some of the other results in F4, the results don't tell the tale. Joshua Carr tried his best to get up there. You know, Malukas, Franzoni, they tried to pass Lundqvist. They couldn't. They got within a rear wing, but passing him was a totally different story.
Yeah, and we started to see a little bit of weakness maybe in Linus Lundqvist standing starts at VIR because Joshua Carr did get the edge on him in one race. And, you know, we thought, okay, maybe that's one area of improvement that he's got to work on. And didn't take him long to chase him back down and get around him. And, you know, as we're going over and rehashing some of these races, I'm trying to put myself back in my mindset as to what I was thinking analytically going into this race as far as what to look for and what to tell people to watch. And Joshua Carr is the one who stood out. You know, he just kind of, and again, he was the F4 champion, just following the ladder system, took his scholarship up to FRA. And, you know, although Mid-Ohio, it wasn't really a good indicator on how things were going to go entirely. And I say that, of course, knowing that Lena swept the weekend. But we get to VIR, and, you know, Josh was just quick. And he's not just, you know, quick for one race. He was quick for all three. And he ran well pretty much all throughout, and he challenged Linus on a couple of occasions. And then it seemed as though once Linus knew there was a handful of laps to go, he would start to extend the margin back to Carr, who was in second. And so we left VIR thinking that Joshua was going to be the guy to challenge this kid. You know, it was going to be a Joshua Carr and Linus Lundqvist show. And I also want to throw in that VIR happened to be one of the stops where the Newman Wachs driver, Jordan Misick, who was a rookie, who came from an entirely different discipline of cars. He had some kart experience. He ran a Radical Cup in North America. And now he was jumping into an open wheel vehicle for the first time of this nature, I should say. And he was able to grab a podium in one of the early rounds. He did have a rare mistake in one of the midway parts of the weekend. But as we're starting to compartmentalize or handicap the field, these are a couple of names which were at the top and we thought were going to stay there. And then things would start to shift a little bit when we headed back over to Barber. But Linus was still perfect. At the time that we left VIR, he was 5 for 5.
And we would see this play out. And I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, David Malukas, because you take a look at the sheets. Anytime you saw Linus Lundqvist on the podium, David Malukas was there, and that is a credit to somebody who started off their season as quickest in practice at St. Petersburg and Indy Lights, and then season's over for Indy Lights, you know. So for someone to have to throw into a new car, hardly any testing, David Malukas proved to me that he's going to be somebody to watch next year in Indy Lights.
I agree, absolutely. And of course, you know, we're talking about Joshua Carr and Jordan Misick.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. Malukas, his podium streak is almost just as impressive as Linus Lundqvist's winning streak.
Yeah.
Because Malukas was pretty much on the podium for the entire season, minus when he spun out of the lead at Sebring. And I believe there was one other race where he may have had a little bit of misfortune, just missed out. I'll have to go back and check my results. But nevertheless, he was a podium snatcher. Ended up with 2 wins on the season. But I will tell you, he's a driver who knows how to find the limit. You know, if you go back, you look at Kyle Busch, stock car driver now, and just how successful his career is. You know, the unfortunate thing for David Malukas is, if you YouTube his name, the Indy Lights wreck comes up. And that does not define this kid's talent at all. As a matter of fact, I can relate it to when Kyle Busch first jumped in a cup car. If you go back and watch it wasn't his official rookie season, but back when Hendrick was fielding an additional car for him at some of the races in 2004, he wadded him up, and a lot. Practice, mm-hmm. Qualifying, you name it. Trying to find that edge and trying to find that limit. Now, in open wheel racing, a lot of drivers don't get an opportunity to go through those growing pains. And David, fortunately, has been able to build a very strong relationship with HMD Motorsports, and they've stuck with him as he finds some of the limitations of not his driving ability, but of his race car. And there were a couple of early rounds throughout practice, VIR being one of them. The car would come back in on the hook, not because he wadded it up big time, but because he got off track, damaged the wing, and he would brush it off, and his confidence would be back at a peak the following day, and he would be right back up there in the top three in the running order. That is something that I want to credit Malukas with as far as his ability to not get a little bit bothered, or, you know, even while he's watching Linus Lundqvist rack up all these wins and these points, he still came out on his A game each and every round and each and every stop. And finally, he would be able to get that all elusive victory. It would come by virtue of a mistake by the Global Racing Group at Sebring when they didn't get the engine cover tightened down on Linus's car. But, you know, Malukas was able to finally reap the rewards of all that hard work and finding his limitations in this FRA car with HMD, who, as you mentioned earlier, you know, they had to learn this car entirely themselves in less than 2 months' time. So I'm with you. I think Malukas is going to be one of the front runners for sure once Indy Lights gets underway. And I'm very excited to see you know, this bit of a rivalry. Even though the two, you know, haven't had any run-ins on track, they've shared time on the podium together for a long period of time throughout 2020. I'm excited to watch them both laterally move over to Indy Lights, being Lundqvist and Balukas next season.
Yeah, next year's Indy Lights is going to be awesome. But I do want to talk about Sebring, because not only did David Malukas win for the first time, that was also his birthday weekend too, so it was a great birthday present for him. It was kind of a shock to see what happened with, you know, the Global Racing Group team with in regards to Lance Lundqvist, because you don't expect that to happen to them.
Not at all. I mean, if you look across the board on all four of their cars, you rarely saw a mechanical misstep like that. So for it to happen to Lundqvist, and I'll be honest, I didn't catch it originally on the broadcast. I just happened to kind of overlook the fact that that big orange paint on the engine cover was gone. Mm-hmm. And the blackness of it just kind of blended in with the rest of the car for a while. And Lundqvist would eventually fade down to sixth. But in his professional manner, you know, he didn't throw his team under the bus. He said, oh, it was just a mistake. You know, he didn't harp on it. He didn't, you know, let it drag out. He didn't drag anybody through the mud specifically. And, of course, it was something that, you know, they too had to do what they could to get over it, because, you know, it's a relatively embarrassing mistake for sure. But, you know, Sebring, with a track that is as abrasive and bumpy and tough, I mean, we don't know how egregious of a mistake it might have been. It might have been, you know, just the right amount for Sebring to be able to kind of, you know, throw you for a curveball. I wonder if they made the same mistake at Homestead with that track being a little bit smoother, if the result would have been the same. But, you know, nevertheless, Malukas, though, a lot of people may say that was a win he kind of backed into at Sebring, but he went back out there the following day or the following race, and he actually was able to race Lundqvist heads up, and he was leading for almost the first half of that event before he made a mistake in 17 and lost the back end of his car and took him out of contention. But the funny thing about Malukas winning on his birthday weekend, first chance that he had an opportunity to talk to Craig Minervini in victory lane. Now, as you know, Dave is from your neck of the woods. He's out. He's from Chicago.
Yes.
He's frequent to cold weather.
Yes.
He absolutely hates the Florida heat.
Yep.
But he was still able to prosper in it. And he was very happy to get up and out of there and go home and celebrate back in a climate which he's more familiar with.
Yeah, that was a weekend, if I remember, that he's down there in shorts. And I interviewed him after the Sebring race. And I'm like, dude, I'm jealous. You know, I'm sitting here freezing. He goes, oh, I wish I was back home. I'm like, well, you want to trade places? So yeah, then, you know, team stayed down there in Florida, raced at Homestead. And I want to highlight that third race at Homestead, because that was the race where we saw Malukas and Lundqvist once again go toe-to-toe, mano-a-mano for the race lead, and Malukas is able to hold him off at the end.
I would have bet everything that Lundqvist was going to get the job done because of how quickly he was closing. And then, even better yet, but as he was closing towards the latter stages, Malukas made a huge mistake in turn one. And it was typical Florida weather. We had some wet weather move in. So even though the pavement began to dry out nicely, the grass was just saturated because it had rained heavily. Typical Florida thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Malukas got all four tires off of the grass. And I thought he was done. Didn't even think he was going to be able to get it back out. Not only did he get back up on the pavement, kept the lead by a few tenths of a second, but he was able to extend the margin a little bit more as the race ticked on. And again, you know, we're trying to talk about Malukas going Indy Lights next season. I think that drive was probably one of the best in his short career because, you know, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't flawless. It didn't go without any type of, you know, error or mistake. But being able to combat those problems and being able to come back from sliding the left front and getting off into the grass and having the champion bearing down your back and still being able to get the job done, that says a lot about his ability to handle things under pressure. And, you know, and I know that Lundqvist wanted that one as well because he was trying to break the all-time win record that was set by Kyle Kirkwood, and losing this second race of 17 to Malukas only gave him the chance to tie that record. So it meant a lot to Lundqvist, even though the title was tied up. But it was a great showing of what these two are probably going to be doing for many years to come.
And then we go to COTA, and Lundqvist sweeps the weekend. We saw that Victor Franzoni and David Malukas both battling each other. And I think that that's going to be a sign of things to come in, like you said, next year with Indy Lights. You know, hopefully Franzoni can get a seat, you know, either in FR Americas or Indy Lights. Malukas, you know, most likely will be somewhere in Indy Lights. We don't know where Linus is going to be. And you mentioned Kyle Kirkwood as well. He just signed with Andretti Autosport in one of their four seats. So the ladder system in racing is not going to be hurting for talent next year. It's a matter of car count in certain series. Hopefully FR America's ends up on the good side. We know Hunter Yaney's going to be there. Marco Kasich, we saw make his season debut at Cody. He scored a point. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next couple months in the offseason. There's a lot of questions up in the air, especially with, pairing with SVRA, with F4 and FR Americas having, some separate race weekends, something we haven't seen before in the series. FR Americas going back north of the border to Three Rivers.
Yeah, there is a lot to still be decided. And obviously, this is the part of the year where, it's musical chairs. And it happens for a lot of people within the industry, not just the drivers, but the same thing with some of the people, the men and women who turn wrenches on these machines, or even, in our case, Jeremy, some of the people who cover the sport, yep, where you're not quite sure of, what tomorrow may hold. I told my wife a few weeks ago, I'm very envious of Linus Lundqvist. And she said, why? Because he's a really good race car driver. I said, well, that's obvious. I said, but he's one of the few people who knows exactly what he's doing next year. It may not be fully set in print or out in the open as far as, what particular car it may be or what the number will be or whatever, but he pretty much knows his agenda for 2021, while a lot of people don't. I will say, you mentioned Victor Franzoni and, Newman Watts Racing. We brought up Jordan Misig earlier, and Jordan is incredibly receptive and appreciative of all of the available coaching that Franzoni's been able to do. And he made light of it. Victor, at the season-ending awards banquet, even though he's in his early to mid-20s, he kind of stood up there and said, I feel like the grandpa here. I'm pretty much the oldest one in the room. And he did say he doesn't know what he's doing next year. I do hope that he does have a landing spot, because if you go back and you look up his stats in Indy Lights competition, add on some of the additional experience he's been able to garner through the years. I believe he was also doing a little bit of Radical Cup racing, or at least testing one along with Jordan Misig this weekend down at Road Atlanta, as a matter of fact. So he's keeping himself fresh. He's one of the most physically fit drivers in the paddock, and I think he deserves another opportunity. But, man, we're getting to a point where that music's going to stop, and I'm not sure how many seats are going to be left.
Jordan actually also a winner in one of the Radical Cup 1500 races this weekend. So that's something to watch out for. Not surprising, knowing how well Jordan has taken to those radicals. But yeah, next year's going to be pretty interesting, to say the least. The schedule's out. We know that much. But what's going to happen next? I think time will tell in the next couple of weeks. Eric, as always, thanks for joining us. We'll get you back on some other time. I know we've got a lot of features coming through the pipeline, but we'll do some bench racing throughout the year.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy. I mean, you and I talk regularly during the week. And, yep. I'm not sure if I'll have a chance to tell you this before, the holidays come, but if not, happy holidays to you and your family.
You as well. And that does it for Inside Open Wheel. We're not going to have an episode next week because some of us are going to be smoking a turkey. You'll be able to see the smokestack from miles away. Coming up after Thanksgiving, though, we will have our big IndyCar Road to Indy wrap-up show as well. So for everyone here, happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you next time on Inside Open Wheel.